Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am appearing this morning on behalf of Regina McGuire. Ms. McGuire is a long-term employee of the city of Springfield, Illinois. This case arises because of an incident which occurred in May of 1998 when she was involuntarily removed from the system operator training program sponsored by the city's Department of Public Utilities. Before the district court, she contended that she was the victim of retaliation because of her effort in pursuing an earlier claim of gender discrimination. The district court granted the city's motion for summary judgment for two separate reasons. The first reason is it concluded there was no causal connection between the plaintiff's protected activity and her subsequent removal from the training program because of the time span that elapsed between those two events. Its second contention, and it's really...
Did you ever complain to the Illinois Department of Human Rights about the city's behavior?
Not to the Department of Human Rights. No.
I'm surprised, because one would think that if the gravamen of the complaint is that the city did not provide the opportunity that the Department of Human Rights required, that that's not, one can't think of that as a violation of, sorry, as retaliation for the order. It's a violation of the order. Suppose the Department of Human Rights had ordered the city of Springfield to pay your client $1 million in cash, and the city, instead of paying $1 million, had paid $100,000 and said, that's all we're good for. You wouldn't describe that as retaliation for complaining to the IDHR. You would say they hadn't carried out the IDHR's instructions. My puzzle is, why is this any different? It sounds to me like the gravamen of your complaint is that the city didn't fully carry out the IDHR's order.
Well, certainly that is one of our beliefs. And
then you complain to the IDHR rather than to a federal court, because there's no federal rule that cities have to carry out state agencies' orders.
That's true. I have two responses. Number one, and although it's not in the record, the plaintiff did file a civil lawsuit under the provisions of the Illinois Human Rights Act contending that the city violated the commission's order. That's not in this record.
Whoa. Now it sounds like we got ourselves a race judicata problem. If you got one transaction, there can be only one lawsuit, not two lawsuits.
There has been no ruling in that lawsuit, Your Honor.
Oh, all right. So this is the first lawsuit.
Yes.
And if you lose this, presumably you're going to lose the IDHR lawsuit on race judicata grounds.
I suspect. Yes. The second...
Right. Well, then my big puzzle is, why are these not all in one lawsuit? Why are you all splitting claims?
It is our view in this case that the statute was violated. The statute reads that an employer cannot discriminate against an employee because of his engagement in protected activity.
Well, let's take my hypothetical. The IDHR requires the city of Springfield to pay your client $1 million cold cash. City of Springfield writes a check for $100,000 and says, you're not getting one more penny from us. Can you then sue in federal court and say that the failure to pay the whole $1 million is, quote, retaliation for filing the complaint?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so why is this any different? You didn't get, on your view, you didn't get everything the IDHR specified. That's all.
Well, I think the situations are distinguishable. In this case, in order for the plaintiff to receive what she was entitled to under the commission's order, she had to satisfactorily complete the training. Our view is the city had a disincentive to see that she failed, that disincentive being twofold. Number one, it would save somewhat in excess of $125,000. Secondly, the individuals who were responsible for determining whether she passed or failed would have been left senior.
I don't see any difference between that and my hypothetical. The claim, it is certainly expensive in my hypothetical for the city to pay the whole million. City has an incentive to make every excuse it can. Many cities in Illinois don't pay in full all the judgments entered against them anytime soon, and sometimes not at all. It's not clear that that's retaliation. I don't know whether you've looked up our case called Evans against Chicago, an en banc decision, holding that failure to timely pay a judgment in a civil rights case is not an independent violation of civil rights. And this just looks like a kind of specific performance version of Evans.
I will have to confess I'm not familiar with the Evans holding. Our view in this case is that the statute provides one will not discriminate because of engaging in protected activity. And in this case, the commission's order was the product of the plaintiff's protected activity. You cannot separate the two. The commission order was not a closed book in May of 1998.
Then I think you have to ask us to overrule Evans. Because the judgments entered in Evans, many of them, were judgments for violation of federal civil rights. And the claim was that it was a separate civil rights violation not to fully pay all the judgments entered. And actually, a panel of this court once held that, but we overruled it en banc.
May I ask, was the Evans a retaliation claim?
It didn't matter how it was phrased. It seems to me very difficult to say not fully doing everything a state agency orders is retaliation for the state agency's order. It's almost, I've made my point, but I just don't see the difference between a state agency that orders specific performance and a state agency that orders payment of money.
The statute that brings this case to this court says you cannot discriminate because of engaging in protected activities. It does not distinguish what type of protected activities would be involved. In this case, the protected activities yielded this particular result. And it's our view that if the plaintiff was terminated to prevent her from receiving the fruits of her victory, she was necessarily terminated because of her engagement in protected activity. And that being the case, we feel that there was evidence that the two events were related, at least for purposes of establishing a prima facie claim.
Counsel, what's your strongest evidence to demonstrate that the committee did not honestly believe that McGuire was not competent to be a systems operator?
I would say the strongest is how they treated her in terms of providing her training while it was claiming that her performance was unsatisfactory. It was during the second year of her training that these performance deficiencies were noted. And at that particular time, the concerns of the city related to the plaintiff's lack of proficiency in doing some of the work that system operators do, specifically writing what's called switching orders. It had been the practice of the city that when an individual reaches the second year of training, that individual is expected to work approximately 50% of his or her time at the desk with the operator who is training the trainee on switching activities. In this case, the plaintiff worked less than 25% of her time doing other things. She verbalized her concerns about not getting more training. She did it through a multiple of ways, including eventually having her lawyer write to the city. And notwithstanding that, she was still receiving less than the norm in training.
Isn't it true that almost all of her evaluations were negative?
No.
Almost all of them? At the level 3?
I wouldn't say almost all, and I don't have percentage terms, but I will say that more than half of her evaluations were
negative. Well, more than half, isn't it?
I don't want to split hairs, but clearly more than half were negative. Interestingly,
if they were, then why should they continue to keep her in the position?
Well,
to keep trying to advance her once they make that determination that she can't do the job.
Well, we believe that they were setting her up for failure, and we base that
on. Do you believe that there was a conspiracy among those supervisors that found her to be so inadequate?
I think that could be a fair inference to be drawn from the evidence.
There were that many dishonest people in that department evaluating her.
I think if you compare how these people, what they wrote in their evaluations and how they treated her, there was an inconsistency that would suggest she was not as bad an employee as they were claiming in her evaluations. Let me give you one example. One of the individuals who consistently gave her bad evaluations was a man named McAllister. And during his deposition, he testified that it was his practice when he worked with a trainee who was having substandard performance problems, he would either talk directly with the trainee about those problems, or he would direct the system operator who worked with the trainee to talk with her about those problems. Now, during the last 4 months of the plaintiff's employment as a trainee, he worked with her, and he didn't follow that practice with her. One must wonder, if she was as bad as he claimed, why did he deviate from that particular policy? Number two,
or could it be that he thought, this is our only chance to help her to do it this way?
That may be an inference that could be drawn.
Well, isn't that as equally good an inference as yours?
Well, I have a bias. I'm not sure that I agree with that. But assuming that is, it seems to me that the court crossed the line and started to draw from competing inferences, which I don't think is a proper function in summary judgment.
Didn't the city, at a couple intervals, Mr. Baker, try to expand the time frame for the probationary period to try to accommodate some of these problems? Isn't that a pretty strong inference the other way, that they were trying in some fashion, unless that's part of the conspiracy, to accommodate the plaintiff?
Well, certainly that argument can be made, but for two reasons I think there is a competing inference. The first is that the city has suggested that in March of 1998 the plaintiff's training period had come to an end, and it gratuitously extended it. That's not the case. The collective bargaining agreement that regulated operator trainees provided for a 3-year training, and if an individual had prior relevant experience, that could be substituted to shorten the training. So in fact, under the contract, her training was not extended. At the time she was terminated, it's my recollection that she was at 2.5 years in her training, so at least under the contract she had 3 years. The second point that should be made is the reason her training was extended, according to the city, it was because it had a concern that she did not have a comfort level in doing the type of work that system operators did, and that she needed more experience working at the system operation desk, and that's why her training was extended. Nonetheless, during that period of 8 weeks that her training was extended, when a trainee is expected under normal circumstances to essentially do the work of a system operator, the plaintiff spent 4 of those weeks, approximately half that time, working in the field outside the presence of a system operator. It would suggest to me that if the city really wanted the plaintiff to succeed, it would have given her more time doing the work of a system operator rather than less.
Well, we're not, as they say, a personnel department here. I mean, is there a suggestion that outside work was somehow a ruse or not in furtherance of her employment opportunities?
It's our position that the city treated her differently than how they normally treated not only a trainee, but also a trainee that had performance problems. And I suggest that two inferences might be drawn from that. Number one, she wasn't as bad as the city claimed, otherwise she would have been given training consistent with the training that would be afforded a problem trainee. Or number two, that the city was setting her up for failure. Now, there are other inferences that can go the other way, but that's why we have juries to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Mr. Rogers?
May it please the court, my name is Robert Rogers. I represent the...
Can you talk a little louder, please?
Certainly. My name is Robert Rogers, and I represent the appellee, the city of Springfield, Illinois, in this case. As Mr. Baker indicated to you gentlemen, the plaintiff, Regina McGuire, has been employed by the city for over 26 years, and she's still employed by the city. The position that she sought, system operator, is one of the most important positions in our electric department. It's a position that literally controls the lives of people. You have to be able to shut off that power properly. If you don't, a lineman can be electrocuted. That's why they have an extensive training program going over this 2.5 to 3 year period. The sex discrimination claim that was filed in the Human Rights before the Human Rights Commission was in 1987. The adverse employment action, alleged adverse employment action, was in 1998. That's 11 years. By no stretch of the imagination can the plaintiff rely on temporal proximity to prove a causal nexus between the protected expression by filing the claim, the adverse employment action by terminating her from the training program.
I don't understand what this causal nexus has to do with anything, since being in the training program is a benefit of having filed the complaint, not a detriment. Right? All she's claiming is that she didn't get the full benefit to which she was entitled. One ordinarily thinks of retaliation as a detriment, not less of a benefit.
Correct. I think
so. Why aren't you making that argument rather than this temporal proximity argument?
Well, because
which might be relevant for somebody who received a detriment, but just doesn't seem to have any bearing on failure to come through with the full benefit.
Because I wrote the brief, and that's the argument I wish to make. If you wrote the brief, you'd make that argument. My position is, based upon the cases of this court, that you have to show a causal nexus. And this case has said that over and over, and this court has said that over and over again.
Is this the ground on which you wish to stand, then?
It's the ground we wrote our brief on.
Hmm.
And there is, simply is no proof of a causal nexus. The appellant, the plaintiff argues that certain kind of you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't kind of arguments. One is because she was placed into the program by order of the Human Relations Commission, and the commission said she had to successfully complete the training program. If she's washed out of the training program, she doesn't get her back pay. Something like $125,000. Well, I don't think that was the purpose of the Human Relations Commission's order to set the city up for having to pass her through this training program, because the plaintiff argues, if you don't pass me, you've cut me off from my back pay, therefore you've created the causal nexus, and I've stated a prima facie case. The second is the seniority issue. That's the same type of complaint, that there's only a handful of system operators. The fact that she was going to bump them in seniority, they would have a motive to try and wash her out of the system. Again, that's embedded in the Human Relations Commission's order. It's all always this catch-22, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, city. The same way with knowledge of the claim. The plaintiff in her brief says, well, everybody knew I filed this action with the Human Rights Commission. Well, of course they did. She showed up for work. They had to explain to the system operators why she was there. She didn't come into the program in the ordinary manner. She was put in there pursuant to commission order. Of course the supervisor, Mr. Hickey, knew that she had filed a cause of action and it was pursuant to the commission order. Again, the city is put in a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't position by the plaintiff saying that, well, yeah, it cost me money, they had a motive, therefore I can prove causal nexus. I think it's clear that this court has placed a great deal of emphasis on temporal proximity. I don't think that necessarily that's the only way you need to prove causal connection, but there has been no showing here of any persistent antagonism from the time she filed her claim before the Human Relations Commission in 1987. Until 1998, when she was washed out of the program. She didn't begin the program until 1995. That's 8 years. No pattern of persistent antagonism. She got through Operation Trainee fine. That's in the record. Nobody disputes that. She got through Operation Trainee 2 fine. Now she's in the most important phase, Operation Trainee 3, and you know the record is overwhelming that her evaluations were poor. She would literally be shaking at the system controls. The operators did not have confidence in her ability to run the city's electrical system. And by unanimous vote of 5 persons, the 4 people on the committee, and the training supervisor, Mr. Hickey, she was washed out of the program. Now, it's true that she went through the 6-month probationary period of Operation Trainee 3, and she was supposed to then go into 6 months work as a system operator, but still under the jurisdiction of the training committee. They gave her another 2 months to try and get a grip on the job. She couldn't do it. It's an extremely important position, and people's lives are on the line. I think the record is clear that there's no causal connection, and the city was justified in terminating her. And I would respectfully request that you affirm Judge Mill's order. Thank you.
The case will be taken under advisement. We thank both counsel, and the court will proceed.